Hi, and welcome to Fair Conversations, part of the Mormon Faircast. To learn more about Fair or to make donations, visit fairlds.org. I'm Blair Hodges, host of Fair Conversations. In today's episode, I'm talking with Tom Mould. Mould is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Folklore at Elon University in North Carolina, and he's the author of perhaps my favorite Mormon-themed book of 2011. It's called Still the Small Voice, Narrative Personal Revelation and the Mormon Folk Tradition. Perhaps more than anything else, Mould's work explores the stories Mormons share about personal revelation in order to highlight Mormon anxieties, hopes, and values. Questions or comments about this or any other episode of the Fair Podcast can be emailed to podcast@fairlds.org. All right, welcome to another episode of Fair Conversations. I'm host Blair Hodges, and today I'm joined by Tom Mould. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Thank you for having me, Blair.
I just want to start off by giving you a minute to introduce yourself, your background, and tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I am a professor at Elon University. Elon's a small liberal arts university in North Carolina. My undergraduate degree is in English literature. My master's and PhD are both in the field of folklore, which is not a field a whole lot of folks know about, but it's probably best understood as a combination between the fields of anthropology and English in terms of a kind of a focus on narrative. Certainly there are people in folklore who study material culture and things, but that's sort of the origins of our field, which means that I study expressive culture. So anything that people are doing in small groups that usually has an aesthetic component to it. Certainly storytelling, oral narratives, oral traditions fit within that realm. My work has been focused particularly on narrative, maybe more particularly on sacred narratives. I've written a couple of books on the narrative traditions of the Choctaw, which is a tribe, a Mississippi band of Choctaw Indians, a tribe in Mississippi, obviously. And one of the books was focused on prophecy, and that's what sort of got me interested and involved in the current project with Latter-day Saint Personal Revelation.
That leads right into the book itself, which just was published by the Utah State University Press. The name of the book is Still the Small Voice, Narrative, Personal Revelation, and the Mormon Folk Tradition. So you came to this from the area of folklore studies. How did you choose Mormonism as a topic? Having done work on the Choctaw before, how did you come to Mormonism?
Great question. I'll try to give you this sort of shortest version, which is after writing that book on prophecy among the Choctaw, I hadn't seen a whole lot of scholarship out there on the narrative traditions of prophecy. There's certainly lots about prophecy in various fields, but not necessarily people who are taking a specific approach to say, you know, these things are shared primarily as narratives. What does that mean when they come as a narrative versus being written as part of theology and scripture, as part of an ideology, as handled by psychologists, whatever it is? So my plan was I was going to write the great big book on prophetic narratives. But to do that, I thought, well, it's not enough to just have done field work in one place and then do sort of library research in a bunch of others. I should do field work in a couple of other traditions and then, you know, keep building my understanding of the of prophetic narrative and then write the big book. So I have a file cabinet just full of prophetic narrative traditions around the world. And 2 years later, the file on LDS prophecy and revelation was maybe one of the thickest in the file cabinet. So between that and then spending a fortuitous 4-hour bus ride with Sean Tucker, who is one of the people that I worked very closely with here in the Burlington First Ward, who's also a faculty member at Elon. We were team teaching a course. And on this 4-hour bus ride, I started talking to him about my research project, and we started talking about prophecy and revelation among Latter-day Saints. And at the end of the conversation, he said, look, you got to come to church with me. You got to meet some folks. You know, I think this would be a great next project for you. And it was. He was exactly right. And so I credit Sean Tucker, honestly, with a whole lot of the impetus for this project.
And as we mentioned, the focus is on personal revelation. So you shifted from the idea of prophecy specifically over to personal revelation. How did you negotiate that?
Yeah, that again, it's sort of maybe two-pronged. One was Sean and one was the fieldwork I was doing. I had, when I started doing some library research before I hit the field, and was looking at something that Glenn Osland, who's a member of the church, also a folklorist, we were in grad school together, a term he uses is apocalore. So he had been looking at some of the stories that Latter-day Saints would share about the Second Coming, in particular. And I mentioned that to Sean, and I mentioned it to the first few people I started doing field work with. And and as the field work kind of continued, those stories really weren't that interesting to folks. They sort of found them to be a little bit fantastic, a little kind of pulling people too far away from the spiritual and really kind of into the sort of spurious legend realm. Many of them enjoyed sharing them, but they said that that's not really what's at the heart of what we're interested in. And yeah, Sean just said, look, you know, he said, patriarchal blessings, personal revelation, that's where you should focus.
Okay, so it started out with the apocalyptic type stuff, and then you found more. There is an element of that in Mormonism, and less so today than in the earlier times. But I agree, general church membership, personal revelation is certainly discussed a lot more, plays a more fundamental role. So I think that's the strength of the book itself. It's one of the few recent academic books that I've read that have focused on something that contemporary church members can really identify with on a personal level.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. And that's part of, we were talking earlier about emic and edic, these two terms that are fairly alienating but pretty basic. And emic just says that if you do an emic analysis, it means you're trying to get an insider perspective and that you're not coming to the project. I mean, we all, of course, come to the project with ideas of what we want to study, but that we're willing to hear what people are saying, hear what they're interested in, and say, okay, this is what's most meaningful to this group. That's what I'm going to focus on. And that's what happened. And there's a colleague of mine at BYU, Eric Eliason, who is a member of the church. And when I gave my first paper about personal revelation from a folklore perspective, you know, he sat there and kind of really sort of felt like he was banging his head on the desk. He said, I cannot believe I've been studying, you know, LDS folklore all my life, all my career, and it never occurred to me to study these narratives. And yet they're so fundamental to, you know, my own life, the spiritual life I see of my peers. So it really does seem to have been something that's just, you know, so central to the church, to contemporary, as you say, contemporary lives of LDS members.
And before we get into even more specifics about the book, you've identified what sets your book apart from some of the earlier folklore studies that have been done on Mormonism. Usually earlier ones have focused on things such as stories about the three Nephites, for example, whereas you've taken something like personal revelation sort of as a category rather than a particular, you know, story about a theme, perhaps. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. And, you know, and nothing against, of course, folks who are taking this kind of thematic approach. But that is where folklore scholarship has been, is to sort of focus on. And we do find, you know, once somebody tells the three Nephite legend, man, the three Nephite legends start getting told. I mean, so there's a natural corpus of stories there. And so I think it's a great avenue for exploration. But it seemed time to stand back and say, all right, but what are, again, sort of, what are some of the native categories that people are thinking about when they share their various stories? And it's not just thematic. It's actually based on the experience of receiving revelation from God. And sometimes it involves the three Nephites, and you know what? Sometimes it doesn't. But there's a unity there that deserved attention.
Okay, we're here with Tom Mould. He's the author of Still the Small Voice. And Tom, in the beginning of the book, you give a brief outline of personal revelation as something that's sort of foundational to Mormonism, perhaps beginning with Joseph Smith reporting his visions and revelations. But you say that that's sort of the tip of the iceberg in Mormonism when it comes to personal revelation. Can you explore that that metaphor for us, the tip of the iceberg?
Sure. So I think what I was trying to get at that with that with the metaphor of an iceberg was that I think when people talk about revelation and when people read about revelation, whether in LDS scripture or in various teachings from church leaders, et cetera, or from sacrament meetings, oftentimes it's from the perspective of church leaders and from the Doctrine and Covenants, some of the major revelations that church leaders have received over the years and how those play in directly to theology. And that I see as being sort of the tip of the iceberg, right? It's the part that's visible above the water. It's what people regularly and easily see. But what's sort of the foundation for that revelation is something shared by all members of the church. And so it's a much broader base. It's a much bigger tradition. And what I mean by that, of course, is that every worthy member in the LDS Church has access to personal revelation. And the more righteous and the more that one upholds one's covenants, the more likely and the more sort of open to receiving revelation they are. So what I found that in looking at, you know, sort of the scholarship out there, that tip of the iceberg, it's certainly been addressed and studied from various perspectives, certainly theological, but others as well. But that fundamental base, you know, sort of what people in you know, it's a lay church, but still there is a laity. I mean, the folks who are sitting in the pews on any given Sunday, you know, what is their lived experience of their religion like? And it's fundamentally based around this concept of personal revelation. So that's what the metaphor is trying to do, is to sort of set the stage for this book, which is to say, I don't want to dismiss those very important revelations that church leaders have received, but let's give some attention to the revelations of, you know, the average, and there's no such thing as, of course, an average member, but, you know, of the membership in the church.
I've known some pretty average members, but So your book, then, you also note in the introduction, some books are written to clarify or interpret doctrine, usually by church leaders. Some books are written to give practical advice or to strengthen faith for Mormons to say, how do we receive personal revelation? And your book claims a different heritage, and that's through folklore, and we've talked a little bit about that so far. But I want you to explain a little bit more. When people hear the word folklore, I think sometimes the first thing that comes to mind is, fairy tales or fanciful stories or things like that. So I want you to describe what we mean by folklore from an academic perspective.
Yeah, and you hit right at it, that the term itself is fraught. And oftentimes, those of us who are folklorists and are trained in folklore will say, well, we're anthropologists or, you know, we're in the English department, we study expressive culture. And it's only sort of after people get an idea of what we're doing that we ever even use the F word, because it just sets people off. As it would have for me before when I went to grad school, I didn't know what folklore was. I just knew I was interested in oral traditions, specifically of American Indians at the time. But so from an academic perspective, the field is focused on the study of expressive culture, whether it's material culture, pots, quilts, vernacular housing, log cabins, things like that, to oral traditions, so oral narratives, jokes, riddles, etc., to customary belief systems, so, you know, superstitions and omens and fundamental spiritual belief systems. And so, you know, there was a time when the field was sort of struggling with this idea of, well, do we call certain religions folk religions, or do we recognize that there is folklore within all religions? And what finally, Leonard Primiano is sort of one of my heroes, and it's not completely unproblematic, but he's sort of developed a definition for the study of religious folklore, which is to say every religion has it. And what we're talking about then is, whether you're Catholic or LDS or Muslim or Jewish, there are going to be traditions that are held that are outside the formal scripture, that are enacted by both leadership and laity alike, that really help, if we want to understand the human condition and understand the lived experience, understanding those traditions helps us understand perhaps how people engage with their faith in a way that simply analyzing the theology and the doctrine doesn't, because there is a difference between the two. So I sort of moved the explanation of folklore broadly into the kind of the study of how folklore intersects with the study of religion, but I can clarify.
Well, no, the way that I would have you clarify that is then just tie it into the idea of what you're asking. It seemed to me throughout the book, basically what you do is you interview people, you hear stories, you took notes at sacrament meeting, you interviewed members to hear their stories of when they prayed and received an answer to a question, or when they were what we call it prompted. They were prompted by the Holy Ghost to do something, right. And you analyze these stories, the way that they're told, the settings that they're told in. And it seemed to me what you're trying to get at is the values that those stories tell, rather than saying, let's go through and see if we can verify that they were there at 10 p.m. and things like this. And that's not what you're doing. You're trying to look at what those stories tell us in terms of values, right?
That's exactly right. And so one of the differences people often draw between anthropologists and folklorists is that, and fairly or not, they'll say, well, anthropologists see the stories as the kind of a vessel for getting those values and belief systems out. Folklorists would say, well, we also, so that's part of it, and so that's definitely what I'm up to. But the other part says that as we share our stories, people are skillful in how they share their narratives. And, you know, the narrative is an aesthetic form. And so the folklorist doesn't want to lose sight of those formal aspects, where an anthropologist might say, hey, we just want to get at the kind of the value system underlying it.
What sort of formal aspects do you mean specifically? Are you saying like vocabulary or like?
Yep, absolutely. I mean, so, you know, people are very hesitant to say that person is a good storyteller of a sacred narrative, right? Because it's a sacred experience. We're not supposed to be storytellers about sacred. You can say that, and I talk about a little bit about this in the book, you know, President Monson, long before he became president, people recognized him as a phenomenal storyteller. But typically, when they would talk about his storytelling, it was the stories about the widows or the orphans, or, you know, it was oftentimes more sort of mundane storytelling that they would kind of point to in terms of sort of the formal qualities of being able to have a dramatic tension, introduce, you know, interesting characters. Usually they were pretty humorous and funny. We all know people who have told stories that just want to put you to sleep. They don't go anywhere. They have 1,000 tangents. So it's those qualities that we might sort of dismiss as being superficial. But in point of fact, people have talked about bad stories will not edify you. You know, if the aesthetic qualities aren't there, you may not in fact feel the Holy Ghost in the way that you should, because this was in fact a valid and very real spiritual experience. So that's what I mean by the some of the formal qualities. But to get back to what your initial point was about kind of not asking questions about, you know, did this happen or did this not? My assumption going into any field work is, of course it did. You know, my faith tradition is different. I was raised Catholic. I'm now a member of a UCC church nearby, which is the United Church of Christ. People's experiences with the Holy Ghost, with the divine, and then, of course, other people who are having, you know, supernatural experiences, whether they think of it as divine or not, I assume that those are very real experiences, and that what we can then understand is not, hey, is this person crazy or not? Of course they're not. When we look at the statistics, man, that means a whole lot of crazy people running around the world if you know, people having received personal revelation are deemed insane. But as you say, what does this say about what this particular community and this particular individual cares about, is anxious about? And the anxiety is a very big part of a lot of these, you know. So most personal revelation comes from praying first. And so, you know, in these stories, we hear what people are praying about. And if you want to get at what people are most concerned about and, you know, it's most fundamental to them, think about what they're praying about. And that'll really give you a good window.
That's another way to introduce something that you focus on in the book. You make a distinction between spiritual and temporal revelation. Can you describe the difference between those?
Sure. It's a difference that's talked about in some of the LDS scripture. Well, really, I think in the dictionary, Bible dictionary, and the glossary and the index, when they're trying to kind of parse out some of these terms. But some of those do talk about two different types of revelation. Spiritual revelation being really an awareness and awakening. When people give their testimonies and say, I know this church is true, I know Joseph Smith is a prophet, and people will say, you know, I have that tenet, meaning I know that tenet is true. Those are usually through a spiritual revelation where what's been revealed is the truth of a particular religious tenet. Temporal revelation, on the other hand, gets at maybe what we might call more sort of daily revelations. People might say mundane because they can be things about what school should I send my child to? Should I go to this wedding? Should I marry this particular person that I've met? But because they're coming from the divine and have that divine sanction, you know, they're certainly not mundane, but they are perhaps geared towards the mundane aspects of life. So that's the difference, and it's a difference that there's some foundation for it in reading some of these glossaries and things from the church, but in talking to people and listening to when they tell their various stories of revelation, etc., it's clear that there's a difference between the two. And a lot of it is one is more narrative than the other. Spiritual revelations are hard to sort of narrate because they don't necessarily happen in a single moment. Temporal revelations tend to. You know, there's
right.
A specific prayer, there's a specific moment that they got a response.
We're here with Tom Mould. He's the author of Still the Small Voice. The next question that I have is regarding the church hierarchy itself. You point to a very interesting conundrum, or whatever you want to call it, that church leaders are faced with. On the one hand, we as Mormons believe strongly in personal revelation, where on the other hand, sometimes the hierarchy wants to sort of make sure that what's being communicated is is in line with former revelations and in line with general LDS scriptures. So, and there's an example right. that you point to. Sometimes these revelations will start to circulate around. There's an example of one from the 1960s that you refer to about warning about militant blacks who are going to attack people or something like this.
Right,
and it started circulating around the time of the Civil Rights Movement, and it was supposedly written by John Taylor, and then the church leadership actually released a statement saying, "No, we don't support this. We don't have evidence for this." So, have you looked into how those sorts of stories are circulating today in terms of now we've got the internet? So in the 60s, they didn't have that. So have you looked at all at that sort of an issue where something will start to spread and the church might respond to it and say, "Well, that's not one that we like to spread."
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. And first off, I haven't done much in terms of looking at the blogosphere or, seeing how, and most of these legends are tend to be shared by younger members of the church, but that's certainly not always the case. But I haven't studied or seen a kind of an electronic sharing of these. But I'm not sure that you really need that for these things to kind of spread by wildfire, because you've got so many moments for wards and people within their wards and state conferences, et cetera. And if you're on a mission, my goodness, the mission field, so many places for especially young people, but adults as well, to meet up with other folks, to, be in social / spiritual contexts where people share these stories. And, what we know from the study of contemporary legends is they are impossible to root out. There are examples of corporations, right? So, mice in Coke bottles, or fried rats in Kentucky Fried Chicken buckets, or these various things that corporations have a very a financial reason for trying to kill these things and show that they're not true. And yet we find is when people hear the sort of rebuttal, what they do is it just sometimes cements the idea even more firmly, because they remember, I heard something about that. They don't remember that what they heard was it's wrong. They just remember something about it. Now, the church's approach has been, because of the setup of how, with a central organization being able to send things out to stake presidencies and then to specific wards and then the bishops, is to have bishops read statements on a Sunday morning before a meeting. And I've got a copy of a couple of those. The one I also mentioned, one that's the most recent one that I actually heard when I was doing field work, about President Hinckley and Hinckley's army. And then as people went up and died and sort of were, met their maker, as it were, and mentioned being in Hinckley's army, that they would immediately go into the celestial kingdom and sort of bypass all the bureaucracy.
Yeah, the idea is like generals in the war in heaven, but when you die, people would ask like what prophet you lived under, and they would say, "Well, I lived under Nephi or something," and someone would say, "Oh, I lived under President Hinckley," and then everyone would bow the knee, and
that's that. You got it. That's exactly right. And so, the bishop shared with me the statement that he read that was sent, as I say, from Salt Lake, that said, this isn't true, stop telling these stories, etc. What I don't know is, I haven't gone back into primary or anything and said, "Hey guys, are y'all still telling this story?" But it'll resurface. If something happens where, President Hinckley is sort of brought back to the fore, maybe an anniversary of some type, those stories will come back.
So we can look forward to that. No.
For another statement from the presidency.
The second chapter of your book talks specifically about performance norms, and these are sort of informal rules about how and when members of the church share stories. And you argue that these performance norms can actually impact what details in stories are shared. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about performance norms.
Sure. And this is one that when I've given some talks about this, usually the first question, and it's usually from a Latter-day Saint member, will ask is, are you saying that because there is a sort of a narrative tradition that people are making things up when they share their story? And it's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is that when there's a recognizable genre, when there are recognizable forms or motifs, which might be small themes that kind of come up again and again, if that's part of your experience, you're more likely to share it in the narrative than you would if that wasn't part of the oral tradition. Because what we have to remember is you have an experience which is sort of infinite in the number of things you could talk about, right? I mean, you could add details about what you were wearing and where you were sitting, and typically we realize those are fairly irrelevant. But relevance is very much culturally constrained. And so deciding whether you'd say that, you know, you were prompted once, ignored it, prompted again, ignored it, and then finally when you were prompted the third time, you finally acted. Well, when you've heard enough stories of other people sharing their stories, and they all include, not all, but if many people include that part of the experience, you may be more likely to also include that part of the experience.
Right. I'm going to jump in right there real quick, because there's a specific example that you give that this was a really interesting part of the book to me. You actually brought up a historical story of Wilford Woodruff.
Yeah.
You just explored that in its earliest tellings, mm-hmm. and then you showed how elements were introduced into later tellings of it. Go ahead and describe that.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because so what I was first talking about there was people sharing personal experiences. And one of the things I talk about in this book is there's a very big difference between a person narrating their own experience and a person sharing a secondhand, third-hand, fourth-hand story of somebody else's experience. And what we see in the Wilford Woodruff story, and so this story, just very briefly, I think you know any member of the church is going to know this story, is that Woodruff was with his family camped under a tree in a friend's home, another member of the church, terrible storm, is prompted to get up and move his wagon and move his horses. He does. Half an hour later, lightning bolt hits the tree. It falls and would have crushed Woodruff, his family, the horses, etc. Now, when Wilford Woodruff tells that story, he's pretty darn consistent about it. When other people have shared that story, and so in one case, the story was repeated in the Friend magazine, and one of the moms who had read it to their kids retold the story and added that motif, that instance of being prompted and ignoring the prompting initially and only later doing that. Well, that's kind of a big deal for somebody that, you know, that a leader in the church to have ignored a prompting. Certainly by that point in President Woodruff's career, you would have thought, man, you should know what the still small voice sounds like. You right. should have gotten up and dealt with it immediately, no matter how cold and rainy it was. But for a lay member, it's, you know, part of establishing one's humility in these stories, we often highlight that piece of waiting to be prompted. And so when she retold that story, she had added that in. It wasn't her experience, but it came up. And so that's the kind of the sort of embellishment that maybe people might be worried about in terms of there being an oral tradition with particular norms. The other thing you were talking about was just how many people had stories that sort of fit that kind of that narrative, both in theme and content, that people seem to have sort of really realized, wow, you know, avoiding danger while you're on the road is certainly a common phenomenon for a lot of us. We're going to share these stories. And when we saw a couple of other stories, and I'm forgetting the church member's name. I was going to say Benjamin Franklin. I can't quite remember. But when he narrates his story, it does not have the clear elements of the Woodruff story. When his daughter and some of his family members narrate that story, they, I would argue, knowing the Woodruff story, retell their father or grandfather's story with those elements. All of a sudden, instead of it being a sign at a tavern, it's now a tree, just like in the Woodruff story. It's clearly lightning as opposed to, let's say, wind or something that blows down. So it's in those cases where we pass on the story that those formal elements often kind of creep into the storytelling tradition.
Yeah, one of the formal elements that you bring up that I thought was interesting, and this is again where I think a folklore study of a Mormon revelation really can help members of the church themselves sort of see some of these patterns. You talk about solicited versus unsolicited personal revelation, for examples, and go ahead and talk about that for a second.
Sure, and I'll say a few things, and then if I'm not getting at what you were interested in, just let me know. But one of the differences I was talking about, sort of, you know, the fact that the narrative tradition is different from the experiences that people have. And while people experience personal revelation through prayer, solicited, so people pray, receive some sort of guidance, that is far more common in terms of how people experience personal revelation. The narrative tradition, on the other hand, seems to highlight those revelations that come out of the blue, unsolicited. You're driving along the road, you get this a prompting, an impression, a strong feeling to pull over to the side of the road. You do, and all of a sudden a truck that's out of control comes careening around the corner. You realize I would have been killed if I hadn't listened to the still small voice. Those out of the blue stories are more dramatic. They tend to be far more clearly evidence of a protective God who has got his eye out for you, because even when you're not aware of it, he's watching out for you, as opposed to you being the kind of the instigator in terms of solicited revelation. So there are a lot of reasons why, in terms of a social context and a social setting for sharing stories, that those kinds of experiences might be highlighted more so than the far more common experience of a solicited revelation. There are a lot of other differences as well, which perhaps you'd like me to parse out. I'm not sure.
No, that's perfect. It brings us right into the next question, which actually deals with how you say that echoes of culture pop up in the stories that Mormons share about personal revelation. So these are sort of recurring themes that relate to church culture, things like era and things like age and gender. And that I was hoping you could talk a little bit about, especially about gender, particularly how you've seen the stories that men and women share, and what sort of values are detectable within those stories.
Absolutely. I think the broadest conclusion from analyzing a lot of these stories is that gender roles are still very, very traditional and very conservative, as represented in these stories. So if a story takes place at the home, and so there are lots and lots, I mean, by far the most common stories involve some form of threat or danger. And of those threats and dangers, many, many, many of them, I think like 30% of those stories or more, deal with danger to one's children. When those happen in the home, it's typically they come to women, because women are the ones, I think, you know, that are typically in the home in many of LDS households. They will protect children. Men, on the other hand, still do lots of, figure into protecting their children, but it's really more in terms of rescuing. So if there's danger to children away from the home, or, you know, if one goes missing or lost, it's men typically that go out and sort of find the children and protect them. I do think that's changing, though. One of the families that I became quite close with, he spends more time with his kids at home than she does. He's in school. He was working on a degree. She was out in the workplace. He was also working, but because his schedule was more flexible. And so a number of the revelations he had were about protecting his kids at home. So I think we are starting to see, as the family dynamic and as the, you know, more women are entering the workplace, no matter what one's religious beliefs are, as that shifts, I think we're seeing that shift in revelation as well. In terms of gender, and I don't have a great explanation for this, to be perfectly honest, women tended to get revelations about premortal existence, about children who were yet to be born. Men exclusively had revelations about the spirit world, about after, being either close to death, visiting the spirit world, having dreams, revelatory dreams, etc. And, you know, I think you can make certainly an argument about why women are receiving revelation about children waiting to be born, though men are receiving those too, and that's maybe another thing we could spend some time talking about. I'm not really sure why women aren't having more revelations about the spirit world. When I posed that question to some of the folks that I worked with, some folks did suggest, well, it could be that because the church is a patriarchy, and because men are in leadership roles, etc., that they're not required, but I suppose encouraged to do more of the leadership and thinking about some of these spiritual and theological questions about, you know, what happens when one dies and getting prepared for the spirit world, etc. But, you know, women are up there during sacrament meetings and fast and testimony, and they're in Relief Society too. So not sure how far that one takes us. So I don't have a great explanation for that.
Just drawing the distinction, I thought was interesting, and you, I mean, you go into it a little bit more. That's something that I hope people who are interested in checking out the book can pay some attention to and get some discussion going on that, because I thought that was really a fascinating finding that you pinpointed. The next subject I wanted to bring up deals with the idea of stewardship. This is an idea that you highlight as you'd listen to different people telling their stories. So in Mormonism, we have the idea of stewards, people who can receive revelation. This comes up sometimes in marriage stories where someone, you know, a guy can't. We typically say if a man says, well, I had a revelation that you have to be my wife. Today, that's sort of seen as taboo, I think, as far as people are supposed to receive their own revelations about those sort of things and stewardship. Right. Now, what I'm curious about is, as someone who comes from another Christian tradition, do you see any kind of stewardship idea in other Christian traditions where people talk about perhaps receiving guidance from God and how they can apply that to their own lives? Is there a similar concept to stewardship in other Christian traditions?
That's a great question.
Because in Mormonism, it seems it's partly tied to priesthood. So you've got the idea of, like, you know, the prophet receives revelation on behalf of the whole church, right. A bishop for his ward, a dad or mom for their family, mm-hmm. you know.
Right. Well, you know, and that's part of, you know, as I come to this topic as a folklorist rather than, let's say, a theologian or a religious studies professor, you know, I haven't really looked at other religions in the same way that I've been looking at LDS, even my own faith tradition. But growing up Catholic, for example, I mean, there's the Pope, right? And so the Pope, there's an expectation that he is certainly in contact with God in a revelatory type of way, that, you know, there's a hierarchy system there. You know, women can be nuns, but they can't be priests. I mean, so we do have a kind of some gender divide there too in terms of who can receive certain kinds of messages, etc. You know, Catholics even have the tradition of going and repenting one's sins, you know, to a priest, if it was a mortal sin in particular, before receiving communion, in that, you know, that personal relationship with God is pretty distant for Catholics in a way that for a Latter-day Saints it's not. And so, you know, I didn't grow up thinking I was ever going to get revelation from God, and I didn't know any peers in Catholics that did either.
In your new tradition, do they talk about that at all, as far as guidance from God, personal revelation type?
Well, you know, it's funny. The UCC Church has an ad campaign out actually, which is God is Still Speaking, which actually fits quite nicely with a lot of LDS tenets and theology. So at least there's the kind of a push to say we have to constantly and keep interpreting, reinterpreting scripture, because just as Jesus came and brought us a new covenant from the Old Testament, you know, why do we expect that? I mean, we don't have a new Savior, but why would we expect that we're not constantly getting new guidance and direction from God? And so it's, you know, stay on your toes. But I don't also in my church hear people talking about having received revelation from God either. I have no doubt that some people who are devout and praying for guidance I'm sure they're getting it, but it's not a publicly shared kind of discourse. That could be a congregational thing, of course.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, the question that you ask about the stewardship piece, you know, I think any formal religion is going to have some sort of structure. Not any. I mean, I think there are some, I think, you know, Wiccan, you know, for example, and some of the neo-pagan religions are trying to sort of, you know, deconstruct any kind of hierarchy and some of those kinds of systems. But, you know, any hierarchy is going to have some degree of a concept of stewardship, I think, involved.
How about with the Choctaw? You did the Choctaw, and I guess that was more on like prophecy for the future type things. But is there a stewardship sort of similar idea there? Is where certain people in the Choctaw community would receive those prophecies? Or,
well, you know, there would have been. It would have been the Hopi, which were the sort of the medicine men and doctors and spiritual leaders of the time. You know, in the same way that we might expect our priests and and bishops and church leaders to receive it. So absolutely, they would be the sort of the originators. Now, they don't really have any hopai anymore. There are still some medicine men and medicine women around, though they're, whether they're sort of constructing new prophecies or not is it's hard to say. No one says, oh yeah, that person living today said X. It's more sort of, you know, the elders have said, and they'll sometimes trace it back to, well, my great grandmother, who was a medicine woman, said. So that notion of authority is important. I think, you know, certainly most faith traditions, but even in this case, a kind of a cultural tradition, there are people who have been tapped to fulfill that role of mediator or of, you know, of having a closer relationship with the spiritual powers and being able to bring them forward. So, yeah, I think so. What's, I think, so interesting about the LDS issue of stewardship is what happens when there is a revelation that either that might run counter to either someone else's revelation or, as you say, you know, hey, I got this revelation, you're supposed to marry me, and the woman says, well, I didn't get that revelation.
Yeah.
Or revelation, and I'm supposed to go run screaming in the opposite direction, you know. So I think that poses, because it's just so much more vibrant that everybody can receive revelation, stewardship becomes a much bigger issue than when you're in a culture where only a few, you know, sort of specialized people in specialized roles are expected to be receiving the revelation.
We're here with Tom Mould. He's the author of Still the Small Voice. Another issue, in addition to stewardship, that you bring up, that you identify as within Mormon thought, is the idea of agency and how agency interacts with narratives of personal revelation. So I'll give you a minute to sort of talk about that issue as well.
Sure, absolutely. So as I was, it actually happened, I think, when I was in the archives. BYU and USU, Utah State University, both have phenomenal archives set up by Bert Wilson, who's sort of the preeminent folklore scholar studying Mormon folklore. He is a member of the church himself, and he's just a wonderful guy, as well as a leader in the field. But he set up these archives, and it was in these archives where I was looking at, you know, thousands of manuscripts, and I thought, how do I navigate all of this? And I realized when I was thinking about some of the people that I was talking to, that there really was a big difference between those stories where somebody was received revelation. So a prompting to do something or a vision of the future that might be coming versus sort of God just kind of coming in and taking care of business, right? You know, help, you know, angels appearing to lift heavy machinery off or just making things happen, making things easier. And that people saw those as very distinct phenomenon. And the more work I did, the more clear that division became to me. And I think it leads very clearly to the focus on agency. And, you know, you don't have to go far in terms of LDS doctrine and theology and Christian theology generally, but LDS in particular focuses on that battle in heaven where the devil offers, you know, everybody comes back to heaven. And, you know, Jesus says, no, you know, people have part of being human. Part of this process is the choice, is that people have to have agency to choose God, that's the only route, you know, to coming back into the fold and you know, entering the celestial kingdoms, etc. And so that agency, I think, that's so fundamental to doctrine and theology, shows up as a kind of a dividing line between these experiences, but also in terms of how these stories are shared. I mean, people often talked about, you know, you don't want to tell stories in a manipulative way, where it's sort of like, well, if you're either calling me a liar or you don't believe Joseph Smith was a prophet. You know, you're either calling me a liar or you're saying that the Holy Ghost doesn't come down and visit people today, or, you know, these kinds of things. And so not only does there have to be agency in terms of God providing humans agency through revelation, but also there needs to be, people are thinking about agency in the social context of how they're sharing their stories. You know, as you, with any of these topics, you can go on for another hour, but just, you know, what I found, that so much of the narratives were about interpretation. You know, that the stories really did include all those steps along the way that people were asking, is this the Holy Ghost? Is this divine? Should I act? Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? Is there anything I can do about it? You know, all those questions become fundamental parts, not just of the experience, but they shape the narrative too.
Right, enough to where, and that's, we get books like Gerald Lund's book, I mean, and talks about how to recognize. That's a big a big element. Yeah.
That's exactly right. And then we get and that's where I think, you know, a lot of the writings about personal revelation are very much about, you know, almost like handbooks.
Right.
Sort of in to guide people, because this is so ambiguous. And I think maybe that's one of the other, in terms of kind of pieces to talk about in the larger field of religious folklore and folklore generally, is just the ambiguity of revelation, not just LDS revelation, but what explains that ambiguity? And so, you know, I think some of the folks I talked to said some of that ambiguity is about granting us the agency in making these choices.
In addition to the ambiguity issue, you also talk about anxiety as a factor in personal revelation narratives. Do you have some stories that provide examples of that?
So let's take some of the missionary stories. So clearly, you know, story after story about being prompted to a particular door, using spiritual tracting. You know, when taken at face value, these are stories that provide hope and comfort, right? So that a missionary hears that and says, gosh, you know, it's been a bleak week. Haven't, you know, every door has been slammed in my face, but I, you know, I know these stories, you know, these experiences are out there. However, we know that they're out there because of the deep, deep anxieties and hardships that missionaries face when they're tracting. And so there's a really interesting tension, I think, between, and you know, stories of spirit children, you know, any of these, of saving their children. You know, for every one story of hope, there's this kind of sense that in the background are 10 lived experiences where maybe you didn't get the personal revelation, or, you know, if you need revelation for tracting, then it must be hard and scary, right? It must be a difficult kind of enterprise. So, you know, I think that's something that I want to keep. I think I will never stop thinking about in any of the next studies that I do, is that kind of not from a psychological perspective per se, but that balance between how stories might comfort in some cases, but also sort of open the can of worms of anxieties in others.
There's so much that can be said about that, but
yeah, there is.
But we'll keep going here.
Okay.
The sixth chapter of your book is seems to be pretty unique in terms of what folklore studies typically do. Typically, folklore studies then talk, they use the oral tradition. You point out that in Mormonism, the oral tradition has, in a lot of ways, segued with the written tradition. We're encouraged to keep records and journals, and also in official church publications like the Ensign. And so you make a rhetorical analysis of 2007 Ensign articles. So you went through each issue of the Ensign. Now, this was really cool. I'd just like to hear you talk about that analysis that you did and some of the conclusions that you drew from that.
Sure. As you say, I think, you know, folklore is partly because there's only so much we can tackle at any given time. We have tended to focus on those sort of dynamic oral traditions, that the written traditions, then we can say, okay, then somebody in religious studies or someplace in anthropology, whatever, you know, y'all can study that from a kind of a more textual, you know, clear textual basis. But as you so nicely said, the mandate for record keeping, and the fact that many people actually do it, the fact that the church does have these magazines where the same kinds of stories that are shared orally appear, you know, in these magazines, the fact that so many people, as they get older, start writing down their stories specifically for their children, not just as diaries, as personal reflections, though that's certainly part of it. But with the idea that these are going to be read by their children and grandchildren, et cetera, it sort of becomes ridiculous to say, I'm only going to deal with the oral. You know, you have to take a look at the written, because they're moving back and forth. And so part of that chapter takes a look at some of these family journals and, you know, some of the variations between, you know, the written tradition in this family and the oral traditions, because they're not the same. As you say, the other thing that I did was to take the year, and as I was writing the book, 2007 was the last year that was sort of complete. I was knee deep in 2008, and I wanted a full year to analyze. So I just went through every single article in those 12 issues and looked for any story that talked about revelation or personal revelation. Because the focus of the book was on temporal and not spiritual, that did give me, you know, it allowed me to at least skip over a few of the articles. What I found, I also found very interesting in terms of the kinds of stories we were seeing, but perhaps not surprising. We talked about gender a little bit earlier. One thing was that women tend to write into the Ensign, or at least get published in the Ensign, a lot more often than men. When men do write in, almost always personal revelation is at the heart of what they're sharing. And it's almost always only their own personal experiences. Women will certainly share their own personal experiences, but are also apt to share experiences of their husbands, fathers, brothers, etc. So there does seem to be a kind of, I don't want to say feminization, because it sounds like, you know, if you tell stories or if you write down stories, that makes you feminine, but that more women are involved in some of the oral, these oral record keeping, etc., the genealogy, and so I think that's why they're sharing other people's stories as well, because they're very much engaged in the stories of their husbands and their fathers and grandfathers. You know, the request from the Ensign. I mean, this is a magazine that comes with the authority and the blessing and the stamp of the church, and so, you know, the requests to the lay members to send in stories are very clear. These are supposed to represent gospel doctrine. And so in the oral tradition, where you do get some stories that are ambiguous, it's not clear exactly what the Holy Ghost was prompting one for. The oral tradition might be a bit more dramatic. You know, the editors of the Ensign say, look, we don't want the fantastic. We don't want to kind of convey this sort of burning bush phenomenon of revelation. And so what you find in those stories also is they tend to be far more subtle. Tend to be far more directly tied to a gospel principle. As I said, you know, there seems to be more women represented. I'm trying to think of some of the major themes. I mean, they're covering some of the same things about sort of speaking, genealogy. Oh, I guess one of the biggest shifts is that service is a much bigger theme in the stories that come up in the Ensign. Service to one's church, whether through missionary work or genealogy work or baptism for the dead.
Yeah, you put these into a table. Even you, the number one I think you put was conversion, and I think that usually deals with more truth claims type stuff, spiritual. But the next one would be missionary work. So, you know, missionaries who were prompted to visit a certain, you know, that the story of one more house, you know, one That's more right. house, and then they find the person. And then, you know, people who receive a particular church calling, people who are coping, who need comfort, people who are prompted to help other people who need to know what to say in a certain situation, raising children, temple work, a career or a move, danger, genealogy. And these are all in order of more frequent to less frequent. And
right. And what you're reading there is, I mean, what you're hearing that, you know, like almost everything you said so far is about service to the church, service to one's peers. Yeah, very much so. And
do you find in the oral tradition then that there are more of the, you said, the fantastic type stories that won't appear in the church magazine? Or more interesting to me is the ambiguous stories, or the ones where things don't seem to work out the right way. Did you see any of those in the oral tradition that don't pop up in the Ensign?
Yeah, you do. And you're exactly right. I mean, so, you know, I think one of the reasons why you might see, let's say, some of these more ambiguous experiences is because people share these stories for lots of different reasons. And we can talk about all the different reasons they share for them, you know, later. But one of them is for their own interpretation, is that, you know, I had an experience that maybe I don't fully understand. And so I share it with you, or share it with somebody else in the church who I think might help bring another perspective and help me understand the experience. Well, that kind of that's a dialogue. You don't get dialogue in a magazine. I mean, it's a very extended, I mean, it's a, you know, it's a delayed dialogue, right? I mean, somebody can share a narrative and somebody can pick it up 6 months later and kind of write in a response or something. But you know, so the opportunity for the sort of face-to-face social context of sharing a story allows somebody to work through an interpretation, to get validation for an interpretation, to make sense of something that, you know, for the Ensign, and not even just for the Ensign, but for family records, et cetera, you know, this is supposed to be far more pedagogical and didactic, right? I mean, it's supposed to be, this is going to help you understand this principle, or this is going to be clarity. I mean, you know, that's what these magazines and these journals and diaries are going for, is, you know, religious and theological clarity.
And do you think that raises a problem? I think some people today, I think everybody wants clarity in a certain sense, but there are other people who seem to also revel in the ambiguities of life, right? And in the oral tradition, it's interesting. You said some people will share an ambiguous experience, say a revelation that they felt they received that maybe didn't pan out the way that they thought it would, and you say they'll talk to someone else to sort of work through it. Do you see the what's being published in magazines? Do you think that has an effect on what will later be shared in the oral tradition, where people maybe could discourage people from sharing ambiguous things? Or do you think that would make more people sort of need an outlet for it? So perhaps we might see more ambiguous things being shared, or.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think both of those, I think that's quite insightful. I'm not sure I would be able to predict sort of which way it would go, but I'll kind of parse out each of the things that you said and maybe give my thoughts on them. One is, yeah, I mean, I do think that different traditions satisfy different needs. So I don't think it'll discourage, if I had to make my guess, I don't think that the written tradition would discourage people from sharing those ambiguous revelations, except insofar as they wouldn't share them in more formal settings like sacrament meetings. So, you know, there's an expectation that in those kinds of settings, it is supposed to be sort of instructional, inspirational, to edify, et cetera. But because people have, you know, whether it's in family home evening or just in various kind of social contexts, there are enough social settings for people to have dialogue. I mean, I'm thinking that, you know, so I did not go to Relief Society meetings, but I did go to priesthood meetings, and those were very intimate conversations. I mean, people really bringing tough issues and problems they were facing with family or job or work. And so, you know, sometimes those negotiations were mundane, but man, some of them were about their revelations and about very spiritual things and real spiritual struggles. So I don't think we're going to lose that. But I do think that because it's a formal church magazine, I think people have recognized, well, if I'm doing a formal talk at sacrament meeting, I'm supposed to kind of follow these norms. But I hope we'll never lose those more informal conversations that are happening in these smaller group meetings.
The thing that fascinates me is that you point to just the opportunity for dialogue, because as you mentioned, I mean, the Ensign doesn't really have any sort of vibrant letter to the editor section or anything where you can respond. That's not the point of it. So they don't, you know, they don't encourage that. And in a sacrament meeting talk, everyone sits and receives, you know, you don't raise your hand in sacrament meeting. So that's interesting that in those contexts, you noticed in the records, you noticed that people tend to be more to share the stories that have a solid resolution, that aren't fantastic, that have that the homiletic feel to them. Whereas in a personal setting, you'll find people you found people more willing to share the ambiguous things.
Absolutely, the ones where and Terry Holmes sat up in Sunday school one Sunday, and I think Paul Clayson said something similar, which was, 90% most of my the personal revelations I feel I'll never know how they pan out till I'm dead. And those are, I think, mostly about spiritual revelations about various truths, etc. But temporal ones as well. I mean, Paul Clayson tells a really touching story that clearly affected him deeply emotionally.
Go ahead and can you share that one? Yeah.
Yeah. So he was out. He was living in. I'm not sure where he was living at the time. Maybe he was in Idaho, but he had gone back and was visiting. He was actually, I think, back in Utah. He had a company there. He was doing some work. And he's a wonderful relationship with his wife's family. And so he was going to go and visit them, but also living out in Utah was, get this maybe exactly right, but I want to say it was his wife's sister's ex-husband. So it was sort of, kind of nominally a brother-in-law, but they had divorced. And so he wasn't sort of even technically kind of part of the family anymore, but they were good friends and had a nice relationship. And he was driving to his in-law's house for a visit, and he got a prompting to go and visit his brother-in-law, and he ignored it. And I think it came a couple of times, and he ignored it each time, and he went on, and he visited his in-laws and had a wonderful visit with them, and then flew back home. And I think he was bishop of his ward at the time, and he was sitting as he would during service, and a 2 days later, so it's now Sunday, maybe even a day later, and somebody came in the back door, and he knew it was for him, and he had a note, and his brother-in-law had died, and he, you know, to this day, he has no idea what that meeting would have been with his brother-in-law, if his brother-in-law had something he wanted to tell him, you know, if there was just a last goodbye. He doesn't know. And so that really haunts him. And I think whenever he gets promptings and he sort of toys with, well, that's really inconvenient to follow that prompting or to do that, I think he thinks about that story. And it really, you know, I think he's pretty darn consistent about making sure to follow promptings, you know, from here on out.
See, and that story, it's funny because now that story has reminded me of a story. And this is sort of how these you know, folk things, this is the give and take. So I recall it. President, I believe it was President Eyring, who related a story in General Conference where he was prompted to share the gospel with somebody, a person he knew, or that, you know, and then he had a couple opportunities to do it and he didn't do it,
right?
And the person passed away, and he in this story and just said he doesn't look forward to the day when he meets this person in the spirit world and has to say, you know, I'm sorry that I didn't tell you about this. Now, I could be misremembering this. This is what's interesting, and this bears right into the idea of folk tales and the way that these stories get told, because it might be the case that the story was actually just that he just didn't tell him about the church. I can't be sure that he brought up personal revelation. I think he did. Okay. But now that I've told this story, see, here's an example of where these stories can take on new elements and be shared in, you know, in a and forth and sort of, you know, roll forward.
And at the end of the day, I mean, so, you know, some folks might say, ah, that's really dangerous, you know, especially if it's about a president, you know, you're saying things that might or might not be true. But at the end of the day, what it is allowing us to do, or you and whoever else you're speaking with, is to talk through the ideas that underlie it. So whether, you know, President Eyring said that or not, or whether it involved revelation, it still engages us in a dialogue about things that are relevant to us. And, you know, and might or might not, but might express, you know, our own anxieties about, wow, you know, I actually never thought about the spirit world being a place where I would meet up with people that I might have to atone for, you know,
right.
Reconcile things. And gosh, that gets me thinking. And, you know, but that's, I mean, that's what's so wonderful about, I think, the field of folklore just generally, is that we are, as much as we'll study those intersections of written and online, et cetera, but it's those face-to-face opportunities for dialogue, discourse, for mutual understanding. It's that kind of humanist push or enterprise that we're involved in that makes me love what I do. I mean, you know, if I were only reading books since, you know, and doing, you know, coding and doing thematic analysis of Ensign magazine articles, you know, I'd go crazy. But getting out and talking with people and being part of the family home evenings and sharing in that way, it's really meaningful. And, you know, I've strayed as far afield from where you were, and I apologize, but
no, that's perfect. In fact, I would add to that. I would add to that that's sort of where folklore studies and history in general, in Mormon studies particularly, sort of segues, because we have a rich oral tradition and a rich written tradition, and we have, you know, the sermons of Joseph Smith in Nauvoo were just handwritten notes that were scribbled out in a lot of cases where they weren't transcripts, and so we have these pieces of Joseph Smith that were then later, you know, interpreted by later Mormons and written out in fuller sermons. And so I think folklore studies actually has quite a bit to say about Mormon history in general and about the stories that we share, that not only the personal ones, which, like you, I find fascinating and sometimes very irritating, like if someone receives a personal revelation where I'm like, oh, that's bothersome to me, I don't like that. But but also in terms of, you know, Joseph Smith and stories that we tell about church history. So I think folklore actually has quite a bit to contribute.
Absolutely. And I'll quote Warren Roberts, who is he was the first person to ever receive a PhD in folklore from Indiana University, which has sort of one of the major PhD folklore programs in the country. But what he always used to say was, history writes about the 5%. Folklore writes about the 95%. And so simply by paying attention to not the great leaders, not, you know, not always the people on the, you know, let's say in the pulpit, but that, you know, those histories of everyday life are extremely important in understanding our past, because it's the past that a heck of a lot more of us shared than that, you know, than Napoleon or, you know, whoever we've chosen to kind of focus on. So not only, I think, does folklore have a lot to share just in terms of bringing a voice to a huge group of people, but I also think it does help us parse out, by looking at how oral traditions are shaped, that written traditions are shaped that way too. I mean, I think sometimes we think, oh, well, you know, historians are in the, you know, solely in the business of facts and true or false. And if it's written down, it's far more believable. But man, one of the things that I found in looking at these, the written traditions and oral traditions among family members, was a lot of skepticism about what was written down. And less skepticism sometimes about what was said, because what's said is, you know, we form a relationship. You know who I am. I know who you are. You know, yeah, there might be some embellishment, but we all kind of can joke and we can talk about those ambiguous things. We can talk about those things where, you know what, Grandpa used to have a beer on Saturday night, and, you know, but no one's going to commit that to the family journal, right?
Right.
I mean, so when you're writing for posterity, so I think sometimes we raise kind of the written record and maybe the historical enterprise on a pedestal and drop folklore down as, well, we, you know, maybe we can know a little bit about what people are thinking, but it's sort of, you know, embellished and you can't trust any of it. I think we really have to rethink how we kind of balance those
yeah.
assumptions.
And I think a lot of the new Mormon, the so-called new Mormon history takes yeah. that view of trying to not necessarily to establish a historical date and time and complete authenticity of every word that was said, but to look at the values that those recorded stories tell us about what those people cared about and what they decided to focus on. And so in ways, I think folklore studies sort of anticipated what current Mormon studies are doing. And probably even broader than that, I would broaden it out. So you've written a book about Mormonism. But instead of writing it just for Mormons or anything like that, you've taken Mormonism and personal revelation as something that can cast light on folklore more broadly. So what are your we're about to just a couple more questions, and this one is, so what are those broader, more generally applicable things that you discovered in this study that folklore studies in general would take away from this book about personal revelation?
Great, yeah, and actually, you know, this was a very conscious effort on my part, again, trying to sort of think about various audiences, but at the end of all of the chapters but one, I sort of combined the sort of synthesis part for one of the chapters, but at the end, I do try to say, look, you know, my focus here is a case study. What I really want to understand is personal revelation among Latter-day Saints. However, as you say, you know, this can really shed some light on how we understand religious folklore and folklore generally. And so at the end of each chapter, I try to have these kind of sort of these, it's maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 pages of synthesis that say, what are the big takeaways for the folklorist? I think one of them is the paradox of performance. And this concept of performance, it's a little bit like the term folklore, right? People think performance and you think sort of artificial, staged, masks, costumes, whatever. And as folklorists define performance, what we're really talking about is simply any time somebody kind of puts themselves out there and says, okay, I'm gonna tell a story. I'm going to make a pot. I'm going to perform a dance. That it's sort of saying, hey, look at me. I'm on stage. Now, that move, we do it all the time, but the risk is it's not a very humble move, right, to say, hey, look at me, I'm on stage. When you're talking about religious folklore and sacred narratives, you know, most faith traditions that I'm familiar with, certainly among Latter-day Saints, is an expectation for humility. So the person who stands up at every fast and testimony meeting and is constantly sort of talking about where they traveled and their grandparents and, you know, their grandkids and how much their grandkids love them and how much they love their grandkids, you know, that is seen as sort of a kind of a self-promotion, not very humble in a way that's, you know, that doesn't fit with the cultural norms. And so what I think folklorists need to pay more attention to is the fact that there's often this real paradox. And Richard Bauman, who's kind of really one of the founders of performance theory in our field, who I had the great privilege of working with when I was at Indiana University in the folklore program, has talked a lot about sort of rhetorical moves that people make to sort of, you know, say, you know, it's just little old me. I'm, you know, don't take this, you know, I'm not trying to be big. I'm not trying to be whatever. But they're fairly small rhetorical moves. I think it's deeper than that. I think it's bigger. I think that, you know, in a lot of cases that move for humility is so big, in fact, that, you know, if it seems like you're being too artistic and performative, that's a strike against you. So I think we just need to pay more attention to that kind of that balance. And Diane Goldstein and some other folklorists who have looked at religious narratives have done some of that initial work and have done some great work. I think we just need to do some more. As I said, I think we need to spend more time looking at the synthesis between, you know, the what we typically sort of the bread and butter of folklore studies, oral traditions or material culture, the kind of the hands-on face-to-face interactions, and, you know, some of these new forms. And we're getting new books that are looking at the internet and some of these new ways that people are sharing and conversing. And, you know, that's an area I need to spend more time on. But I think that's another area that I think we need to focus on. I think this idea of narrative distance is something that's talked about a little bit, but not enough. And by narrative distance, I mean the distinction between somebody telling a personal experience, somebody telling an experience of their grandfather, telling an experience that they were present for, but it wasn't sort of their sacred experience. And then as you kind of keep moving farther and farther away, well, now it's my grandmother's experience. Now it's an experience that a neighbor had. Now it's an experience I heard in sacrament meeting. You know, as those stories get farther and farther apart, the assumption has always been greater embellishment, less accurate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what I found in these studies is that the second, you know, it's sort of the secondhand story. It's not a step maybe kind of farther away from the personal experience narrative in terms of being effective. In fact, the secondhand story can be far more effective than a personal experience narrative because you avoid the humility factor. I can tell a story about you, for example, about your experience, and I can make you out to be a saint. You can't do that, but I can. And so I can talk and I can, you know, inspire and edify people, you know, hearing. And so I think we've been too quick to assume a kind of a linear path of degradation or you know, things kind of getting farther and farther away from the truth, et cetera. A couple of things I'll throw out there. One is folklorists, and this goes back to Stith Thompson, who with Antti Aarna, and I'm probably mispronouncing his name, but they worked on a motif index and tale type index for fiction story, for folk tales, that said, hey, look, you know, Cinderella's got this glass slipper. Well, that's a lot like this magical hat. It's a lot like this, you know, that you can sort of substitute these different motifs into a story and build a folk tale out of it. What we haven't done much with is to pay attention to recurring tale types and motifs in nonfiction stories. And so that's one of the things I try to do in looking at the themes and patterns of these revelations was, you know, in point of fact, common experience leads to common narratives, and we should pay attention to that. So I'm not saying, oh, gosh, you know, once you get one story about a, you know, a falling tree from, you know, talking about the Wilford Woodruff story, now everybody's going to start telling, you know, making up stories about their own experiences with falling trees.
Right.
But rather, you know, as these kind of shared experiences happen, that there's going to be, you know, there's going to be kind of a norm for how they get told. And certainly Margaret Brady took a look at what she called spirit children stories, stories of particularly women receiving revelation about unborn children, often where the child would come down in a dream and say, Mom, you know, I'm waiting.
Yeah.
Dad need to get, you know, to have me, bring me to earth. But that once there's a kind of a sort of a corpus of these stories that we can pay attention to patterns that recur. So I think as folklorists, we've got all these motif and tale type indices, you know, for folk tales. We should start doing the same for nonfiction.
I would also look into like the Saturday's Warrior effect on that too. Like there's a point in time when I wonder about those, the revelations of unborn children. I mean, Saturday's Warrior has that this movie from the 70s of this family who has a bunch of children in heaven, and they're all we're ready to go down and we're all going to be a great family. And then they're getting born. And then down on earth, one of the oldest son sort of becomes rebellious and he's down on his parents having so many kids. And there's one child still left up in heaven and she's worried now. She's, you know, and I just wonder if we could make a mark in time. I mean, that motif was earlier in LDS stories as well. Nephi Anderson wrote a book called Added Upon that had the same sort of idea of premortal people meeting up on Earth. And so it'd be right. cool to sort of make it. I mean, there's so many different, you know, things that could be explored here that.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and honestly, when I first sent the perspective of this book to the University Press of Utah State University Press and said, hey, I'm thinking about writing this book. Are y'all interested? One of the chapters was going to be a far more focused kind of historical, you know, where we're going to try to look for those kinds of patterns that you mentioned, which is, you know, in this period, you know, let's say in the civil rights era, you know, we got lots yeah. of stories about fear in terms of racial identities, et cetera, and spirit children maybe being really big in the 70s for what reasons, you know, and try to take a look at that. And then I realized very quickly that's a whole book, you know, yeah. on its own. And what it really involved was I realized I'm like, I need to spend 10 years reading pioneer journals. I mean, starting at that point and kind of working my way forward. And there are, of course, gaps in the record, you know, that we'd have to pay attention to, too. But no, I agree. I think those are fascinating questions. I wish I had the time to tackle them.
The last question I want to explore with you involves the intersection of scholarship and religion itself.
Sure.
So as a practicing Mormon, I approached this book and I thought, you know, this is about personal revelation. So this can be something that can be dissected to the point of annihilation, or it can be, you know, how will this be explored? When does dissection of such an important belief become sort of a murder, you know, to use an extreme term? But
sure.
throughout the book, I found it's a very odd book because it's oddly intellectual, and I also found it devotional as well. And not that you intended it to be that way, but I could draw things from the book itself. So I was hoping you would explore perhaps your own thoughts about approaching religion from an academic standpoint, because some people are afraid of that. They, you know, there's some trepidation there.
Absolutely. And, you know, honestly, I had, you know, and other people may, of course, disagree. I had no idea how it was going to be received. And so when I read your review, I was thrilled because that is a concern. And it's something that, you know, periodically I would, you know, all of the things that I wrote in there, I regularly talked them through with, you know, some of the, not everybody that I worked with, but, you know, some of the key folks, and a couple of them I can't name because they use pseudonyms, but certainly Sean Tucker, you know, that I've mentioned before was one of them, but then just fantastic in terms of being able to bounce ideas off them, but was to kind of, it's tricky, and especially it's tricky when you say, not only am I going to take a look at your religion, but I'm going to take a look at it from a set of perspectives that some of them are going to be emic. I mean, I really am hoping to kind of get some of it, but some of them are going to feel a little weird. I mean, it's, you know, the sort of awkward point was, you know, to what extent are the people that I'm working with going to even recognize the analysis that I'm doing and be comfortable with the analysis that I'm doing that says, you know, I'm looking at some of the formal qualities. I'm looking at the structure of these narratives because, you know, while folks are in, I think, very clearly inherently, there are skilled narrators or skilled people who are putting together a compelling story because these are social settings. You know, they're not dissecting them into narrative triangles. I mean, I've got some graphs and things in there, which I was a little sheepish about including, but I thought they were useful for some of my readers. That said, you know, here's how the questions that people are asking when they're trying to interpret a particular phenomenon actually are the same questions that create the sort of dramatic tension that we look for in terms of narrative analysis. And that was, I thought, really cool.
Some of the charts, I agree. I think some people find it off-putting, but some of them were all visualized what you were saying and actually helped. I found them useful.
Well, which is great. I appreciate that. But, you know, I do know some folks would say, you know, well, as long as it's not wrong, I can live with some of that. And so, you know, you said you found yourself feeling maybe some points of devotion. As you say, also not my intention. I didn't mean to alienate anybody at any stage. However, because people were sharing their sacred stories, if I was doing my work right, if I was allowing them to speak at least somewhat, then I expected the LDS reader to find this to be a useful book in that way. Didn't write it that way, didn't expect it to be, but that was my hope. And so hopefully, at least in a few spots along the way, you actually got to hear from some of the great folks that I got to spend time with and hear what they were saying, and perhaps even be edified, you know, as you read some. But yeah, no, it's you know, your opening quote in your review is dead on, and you know, that panicked the heck out of me when I started reading. I thought, oh man, you know, it's a great point, and I don't know if anybody ever feels like they successfully do that. The same thing is, you know, people say about humor. How do you kill a joke faster than to start analyzing what's funny right. about it? How do you kill the super, you know, the sacred faster than turn it into a mundane analytical treatise?
It's definitely a book I recommend. Again, the name of the book is Still the Small Voice, Narrative, Personal Revelation, and the Mormon Folk Tradition. We were talking today with Tom Mould. We really appreciate you giving us your time and spending some time talking about the book, Tom.
Blair, I can't thank you enough. I had a great time. It's you know, it's always nice to talk about what you spent years and years working on. So I sort of feel like the privilege was all mine. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Good. Yep, you're welcome. Thanks for listening to this episode of Fair Conversations. I'm Blair Hodges, and as always, you can contact me at podcast@fairlds.org with any questions, comments, or suggestions about this or any other episode of Fair Conversations.